every euro that we are investing is reducing at least 2 euros on the ancillary side on the long term. Just give me an example. We commissioned 2 years ago a line in the south of Bremen, Ganderkesee St. Hilfe it was called, just a 60-kilometer AC
Bremen,
line.
Right up in the north.
In the northwest of Germany, and from there, where we have a lot of wind, to the south. A 60-kilometer AC line, rather small. The investment of this line was roughly 1 billion euro. It saved in the first year of operation 500 million of redispatch cost. So after 2 years, it's completely paid, and then it's bringing benefit to the customer.
How long does it take from the moment where you say, do you know what? We just need to build a new line, through to actually pulling the switch and the first electrons to flow? What is the time frame in reality between those two events?
If I come back to the example that I mentioned before, Ganderkesee St. Hilfe, that was one of the very first lines that we built for the energy transition. This took 20 years.
20 years.
20 years, and 17 of those were permitting and licensing.
Hello, I'm Michael Liebreich, and this is Cleaning Up. A few weeks ago, for episode 227, I spoke with John Pettigrew, the outgoing CEO of the UK's National Grid, about the pressures being put on the transmission system by the UK's rapid exit from coal and dash for renewables. This week, we move to continental Europe to hear about how those same pressures are playing out and about the huge capital requirement that they drive. I'm here in Berlin as the guest of TenneT Germany, the largest of Germany's four transmission system operators, and this episode has been supported by them. So, please welcome Tim Meyer-Jürgens, the CEO of TenneT Germany, to Cleaning Up. Tim, thank you very much for joining us here on Cleaning Up today.
Thank you very much for the invite.
Let's start it where we always start, which is, in your own words, who are you and what does TenneT do, or TenneT Germany, but the condensed version?
So my name is Tim Meyer-Jürgens. I'm the CEO of TenneT Germany. TenneT Germany is one out of four German transmission system operators. So we are operating the large transmission line for the electricity grid in Germany. We are part of the TenneT Group. TenneT is also a transmission system operator in the Netherlands, and we have been the first cross-border TSO in Europe. And we have an immense investment program in front of us, and that was the reason why we splitted the company beginning of the year in two national ones, so TenneT Netherlands and TenneT Germany, in order to get investors on board to fund our long-term investments.
Now, I'm going to start also by enforcing one of our rules, which is the acronym KLAXON, and you used an acronym there, which is TSO. And TSO is?
Transmission System Operator.
Very good. And so we had John Pettigrew of National Grid, one of our recent episodes, and I believe you listened to that, but you must know John very well. And of course, he's the grid operator, and then you have the transmission, in the UK, NESO. So which bit are you? Are you the grid operator managing the wires, or are you deciding what goes into the wires?
We are both. So similarly, like National Grid in the past, we have combined the asset operator that is building and maintaining the grid with the system operator that is then operating the grid.
The reason I ask these questions is I think it's our audience, they're all expert in what they do, but not all of them are expert in the grid, or certainly in the way that those responsibilities get split. And presumably within TenneT Germany, you have the same functions, but they are within one organization rather than being split.
Correct. And also differently than National Grid, we don't operate distribution grids. So we are a purely system operator on the transmission side.
Tell us geographically what you cover, because that's also very different from a lot of countries, maybe even most countries, that you've got four TSOs in Germany. So you're one of four, whereas National Grid is one of one in the UK. US, of course, has got these different, a very different structure into its electricity markets. But what's your geographic coverage, and is it a monopoly within that area?
Yeah, indeed. So in Europe, usually you have per country one TSO. That is the normal model. but Germany is the largest electricity market in Europe. And therefore, we have different scale. And also due to historical reasons, we have grown with four transmission system operators. And we all have a natural monopoly in our control area.
Historical reasons, that would be 50 hertz coming from the former East Germany. And that's pretty much follows that boundary. And then whereabouts within
We are the only one connecting the north, where you have a lot of generation, especially renewable generation, with the south, where we have the load center. So we are in the middle of Germany, from north to south, from Denmark to Austria. And then on the eastern side, we have 50 hertz. And on the western side, we have Amprion in the southwest, Transnet BW.
Okay, so now I'm going to, I was thinking, can I get away with saying, so you get the difficult stuff, which is going from offshore wind to Bavaria.
Yeah, so indeed, we have been one of the first ones that was really facing the challenges of the energy transition, because we are connecting those areas with a high surplus of generation with those areas that have a high demand. And that makes us quite unique. That is why we started very early to invest. And that is also the reason why we are nowadays the largest TSO in Germany. If you compare the grid lengths, we are the largest. But if you compare our regulated asset base, we are as large as the other three together.
So there's two subtexts to the conversation. One is, this is a tough challenge with Germany very rapidly going to very, very high levels of variable renewables. So there's a kind of, one subtext is, how on earth do you do that? And the other subtext is really around the vast investment requirement, and how do you keep the money flowing in to fund what you need to do? So there's the physics and the finance. Those are the two big conversations, I think. We'll just start with the context of the finance. I think we'll just do the little bit of the context, and then we'll come back to that afterwards, because you have just gone through this transaction where TenneT Germany was part of just TenneT, which was Holland. It was a Netherlands government-owned organization. But you've separated out. And in fact, you were sort of brought in to steer the organization through that process. So talk a little bit about that, please.
Yes, so indeed, we have been a fully integrated cross-border TSO in the past. I myself was responsible for the operation. So I was the CEO of the TenneT Group for 6 years. But now we are in a phase where we have to invest heavily into our infrastructure because of the energy transition. So we started that already a couple of years ago, but now we are at a scale where the Dutch state, as our shareholders said, we are not willing to continue to provide equity for the German business. And that was the reason why we said, okay, then we split the two companies in order to open up the German business for also external investors.
That process of splitting it and then bringing in equity, which took a couple of years, I mean, it has concluded. Let's talk about how it concluded, who came in, who invested, and also perhaps some of the other pathways that you explored. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. So indeed. So first of all, the Dutch state said to us, the German state is interested, so please speak first of all to the German state.
So first refusal, in a sense, for the German state, right?
Indeed. And then we had about 2 years negotiation with the German state and the KfW under the old government. But at that moment, the government was not able to decide for political reasons. That was also the time when the German government failed. So we said, okay, but we cannot wait.
If I might just come in there, let's just put a quantum on that. You're looking for the equity for the plans we're going to be talking about in some detail. The amount of that, I mean, the eventual deal was 9.5 billion euros. So the first refusal was given to the German state. Have you got 9.5 billion euros to invest in what's effectively a German critical asset? Is that correct?
That's basically correct. We have an investment agenda in front of us only for the next 5 years of 65 billion. And of course, we have a lot of debt financing in order to be able to conduct this this agenda. But on the other hand, we need, of course, equity.
Okay. So first refusal to the German state. German state had other businesses to deal with. We also had the CEO, Michael Lewis, of Uniper. And so that was also taking a bit of time in the finance ministry, I suspect, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and Uniper requiring complete refinancing. So that was all going on. So you then went a different route for the equity piece of your finance requirement. And what was that?
Exactly. Then we said, okay, we will approach the capital markets, and we decided to go for a dual track. So we looked for a private placement, and at the same time, we also prepared an IPO.
Okay, so twin track, private placement, and I'm just going to keep the audience with us here. Private placement is equity investors. It's not on the public markets, so it's not something that your average retail investor would necessarily even know is happening, but it'll be institutional investors, pension funds, sovereign funds, investing in privately. But you did also explore the public route, the IPO route. Which markets did you explore for that?
We've prepared fully to be a listed company, and we explored the European market, of course, so Frankfurt, London, but also the US market. So we have also been to New York, to Boston, and we spoke to many, many investors. And there was a huge interest, I think, also because of the geopolitical situation we are currently in. We saw that people are looking for safe investments. And one of the feedbacks I got in many of these conversations I had is that the investors are looking for security, predictability, and that the European market, and especially Germany, is seen as a kind of safe haven. So the investors are very interested into investing into European infrastructure.
Right. So you've got Europe, which is perhaps not having quite the same turbulent ride as investments in the US, particularly anything around energy and transition and those people trying to do clean energy. So you've got Europe, you've got Germany, and you're a utility. So you had good feedback, but you decided, or you weren't able, whichever it was, not to do the IPO route. Why was that? What was the background? Because you've gone the private route.
Yeah, we prepared both up to the end, so that in the end we had two fully negotiated solutions on the table we could choose from. And finally, our shareholder, our current shareholder, the Dutch Minister of Finance, decided to go for the private route, mainly because of the transaction security. Because now the 9.5 billion equity commitment is in from the beginning. If we would have gone for an IPO, probably there would have been left a small gap. And then there is an uncertainty that, from my perspective, is easily to fill. Nevertheless, for the Dutch state, it was the more certain route, and therefore that was a decisive argument.
Okay, so you've got the Norwegian Oil Fund, the NBIM Fund. Now I have to be careful of my acronyms. So the it's the Norwegian Oil Fund.
It's Norges.
Norges Bank Investment Management. There we go.
Correct.
And in fact, we had Karin Ihanecho-Smith, their head of sustainability, on the show, one of the earlier episodes. So they came in, Temasek came in, and also a private equity. There was a third major player that came into the cap table.
The Dutch pension fund, APG.
APG, there we go.
And then we have from Singapore, GIC.
GIC. Oh, it's not Temasek, GIC. No, yes,
GIC,
correct.
GIC from Singapore, the sovereign fund, and then the Norwegian fund.
Very good. So you've now got committed equity investors. And we're going to come back to the debt requirement, because you've already put out there, though, that you need 65 billion euros over the coming years of equity and debt. Why do you need so much? It seems like every grid operator or John Pettigrew also had a figure of 60 billion, but he had 60 billion pounds. You got 65 billion euros, and that's only for your part of Germany, and only for a few years. These are huge amounts of money. Why do you need so much?
Yeah, because the energy transition will only be successful with a strong infrastructure. We are changing our complete generation profile, and therefore we have different challenges. If you look into our grid today, we have constraints in the grid. And to manage those constraints, we have system services, and they are quite expensive. Half of our grid tariffs are driven by those system services. And the best measure to bring them down is to invest into the grid.
So when you say system services, these would be constraint payments or redispatch payments, or do you want to give, you know, are there others? Paint the full picture, because this is what we're seeing. Is I think this is part of a long-term trend, that it used to be that the main cost of electricity was how much it cost to generate. So there'd be the wholesale price, and then the grid was a little bit, And then you'd have a few charges, maybe a bit of tax and so on, and the retailer margin. But mostly you were worrying about the wholesale cost of electricity. But now, and over the last couple of decades that I've been doing this, we've just seen that middle piece, the grid costs, going up and up and up. But it's not just the fact that you need a grid. It's all of these ancillary services and so on. So how does that look in Germany or in your region?
I would say the good news, first of all, is that renewables are quite competitive. So the wholesale price is going down. But indeed, there are other elements now that are important. And about one third in Germany is about the infrastructure, the grid cost, of which is half transmission and half distribution. I'm speaking for transmission. That is what we are looking at. And as I said, half of our tariffs are driven by those system costs. That is also the reason why we see rather stable tariffs also in the next couple of years, despite we are investing huge amounts, but we are able with these investments to drive down the system service cost. And therefore, we see price stability on the transmission side. It's a little bit different on the distribution side. That's why overall the grid tariffs are going up. But for our part, it's rather the opposite.
So I did an episode with Leonhard Birnbaum of E.ON. Yeah. And, he was also, talking about the huge amounts of investment. So you're essentially blaming him for the costs remaining high because it's the distribution bit, not the transmission bit. Is that right? Is that fair?
No, that's not fair. I know Leo well. And it's not about blaming them. But it's a different system, and it's as important to invest into distribution like to invest into transmission. But there you don't see this constraint in the system costs. So that is why the investments they are doing, they are necessary, but that is why they are reflected then in the tariffs.
Yes.
And we are really reducing with our investments the system costs. And that is why we are in the lucky position that we can keep the tariffs stable and on the long term even bring them down again.
Right. And I think we're painting here a good picture of the system, right? Because you've got on the generating cost, the wholesale side, you have all these renewables being built out very rapidly, also some gas, which we'll need to talk about. But then you've got simultaneously a lot of investment going in on the distribution side to manage it, digitization, last mile, increasing the capacity to serve heat pumps and electric cars and data centers and so on. And then you've got your bit in between. And I guess my question is, isn't it a bit like you squeeze the balloon, you invest because you want to reduce these system services, the ancillary costs, the constraint or redispatch payments, but aren't you going to increase the actual, if you put more capital to work in the grid, somebody has to pay for that, no?
Yeah, but nowadays the customers are paying for the ancillary services. And when I invest, of course, that takes also some money. But this money is saved then on the ancillary side. So and therefore, I think it's a zero level game in the end.
And in John Pettigrew's episode, CEO of National Grid in the UK, he talked about saving £40 of system service costs with investment that would cost £4, I think were the numbers of grid investment. And I didn't have time or the knowledge to challenge him. Is it similar, or are you saying it's one for one? You kind of reduce one redispatch euro, and then you have one more euro to pay for the wires.
If I see it on the very broad level, then I would say every euro that we are investing is reducing at least €2 on the ancillary side on the long term. So it's even bringing the cost down. And to make it very tractionable, just give me an example. We commissioned 2 years ago a line in the south of Bremen, Ganderkesee St. Hilfe it was called, just a 60-kilometer AC line.
Right up in the north.
In the northwest of Germany, and from there, where we have a lot of wind, to the south. It's a 60-kilometer AC line, rather small. The investment of this line was roughly €1 billion. It saved in the first year of operation €500 million of redispatch cost. So after 2 years, it's completely paid, and then it's bringing benefit to the customer. We have another example. Last year, we commissioned Vale Meckler. That's from Hanover, so a little bit more in the middle of Germany, also to the south. This one also saved €350 million in the first year. So you see that every investment that we are doing is paying off rather quick, and then giving benefits back to the customers.
Those are fabulous examples where, in a sense, you've got a constraint today. You've got a redispatch problem today. And that would it would be lovely if the world could work that way, where all you'd need to do is release each constraint. Every time a constraint pops up, you immediately invest, and within 6 months or a year, you would have a lovely brand new transmission line. I'm smiling, you're smiling, because that's not the way it works, is it?
In general, it is the way it works, but at the same time, we are very ambitious on the generation side to ramp up the renewables even much more to be able to fulfill the demand of the future, because also demand side is expected to grow with all the electrification of industry, new data centers. We expect that we will need much more. So while we are investing in reducing the ancillary services, we get more renewables connected to the grid, and this is pushing up the ancillary services again. So that is why we are in a kind of long-term marathon here.
So, but let's just come back to this point about, you know, when I was smiling and saying in 6 months or a year you've built the new line. How long does it take in Germany, which is partly stuff under your control, partly stuff under other people's control, regulators, public inquiries, environmental impact assessments, and so on. How long does it take from the moment where you say, do you know what, we just need to build a new line, or we need to create a new capacity for, you know, to connect up, you know, to create new grid connections? How long does it take from that moment through to actually pulling the switch and the first electrons to flow? What is the time frame in reality between those two events?
If I come back to the example that I mentioned before, Ganeke-Singang-Tulfo, that was one of the very first lines that we built for the energy transition. This took 20 years.
20 years.
20 years, and 17 of those were permitting and licensing. It has improved very much. So until 3-4 years ago, we were on average 10 to 12 years. With the last government under Robert Habeck, there were a lot of acceleration measures, also supported by the European Commission with an emergency regulation because of the war in the Ukraine and the energy crisis. That brought down the realization times to 5 to 8 years. But now we are at the moment where those emergency regulations are running out, and we have to replace them by permanent legislation. And there we are getting stuck now again. So if we don't get a long-term framework that allows 5 to 8 years, then we will go up to 10 to 12 again.
So you've got, let's assume you get that regulation through. I mean, you have a business-friendly government in power. You had a renewables-friendly and or Energiewende-friendly before. Now you've got business-friendly. So let's assume a tailwind on that. But what triggers the moment, what triggers the beginning of that process? And the reason I ask is, if you look at, you've got the people supplying the renewables, project developers, and you've got the people who use the renewables, which would be industry or a utility at the other end that's distributing to its clients. And each of those can operate on a sort of 1-3 year timeframe. We want to do this. We plan it, we get our permits, and we're ready to go. And that takes, you know, a few years. Let's call it 3 years. And at the other end, if it's now building, if it's a new program to roll out to, I don't know, let's call it to put heat pumps into some industrial facility. Big increase in demand, so they start procuring power. And that also, that project will also be a sort of, let's call it a 2-3 year project, realistically, to go through budgeting. So those two ends of the process take, let's call it 2-3 years. At what point do they trigger the optimistically 5-8 year process in the middle to get the transmission from the source of electricity to the demand for electricity?
The system has been, meanwhile, completely decoupled. So we are a fully regulated business. It starts with the climate ambition of the government. So they set the climate target. Then the government is breaking down these targets into what will be the generation profile. So how much solar do I need? How much wind do I need? How much water, biogas, and what else? And then the same is done then with the demand side. So what do we expect? What will be the mega trends? data centers, for example. How much data centers do we expect in the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? This is all put then into a scenario or in three different scenarios. Those scenarios are approved by the regulator, and that are then the basis for the grid planning process. Based on these scenarios, the four TSOs are developing a grid development plan showing for all the three scenarios what is needed on the grid side then to accommodate those scenarios. And this, again, is then publicly consulted by the regulator and also finally approved. And once this plan is approved, that's the basis for us. That is then going to the German parliament. And then the projects are really going into a law where you see in the law this project is needed. And that's the basis then for our investments. So it's completely decoupled from what is happening in reality. But this plan is revisited every 2 years to adjust it to the real development that we are seeing.
It's a real privilege, frankly, to have this explanation from you who know this system so well, because the word that pops into my mind that I probably should have used in the question is anticipatory investment.
Correct.
Because the problem that we've had in so many countries is that the grid operator, the TSO or the grid operator, have to wait by law until both sides are sort of lined up begging. One is begging to supply electricity and one is begging to use it. And then they kick off a process, which historically in some countries, in many countries, has taken 12 or 15 or 17 years. And that obviously is no way to achieve a transition of any sort. So what you're saying is that link has been broken and you have anticipatory investment based on a scenario.
Yeah, it's like a little bit if you have a municipality that wants to have industry in their municipality. What they do is they start to invest into roads, into electrical supply. And when everything is ready, then they say, here's an area where you can invest. And then you are attracting the industry. And that's a little bit the thinking by the system that we have in Germany.
What happens, though, to prices for your services if that demand doesn't materialize? So there's a subtext here, which is Germany had a very ambitious heat pump, electrification of heating plan, very ambitious electrification of transport plans. If those don't happen, then inevitably you will have invested because you started in good faith a few years back. Then does that still get passed on, but now to a much smaller user base because the megawatt hours you were expecting, the gigawatt hours you were expecting didn't materialize? So you divide the same number of investment by a smaller user base. Is that a risk?
Yeah, so we have to divide the risk from a country perspective and also from a company perspective. So as a company, as I said, we are in a regulatory system. It's expected from us to invest in good faith, and we are also protected. So as a company, I'm not running a risk here. Nevertheless, of course, as a country, we want to have an efficient system. Therefore, it's important that your forecast comes very close to what happens in reality. And that is why the plan is revisited every 2 years and then adapted to what is really happening. So, and then if you see the entire scale of the German energy market, of course, in the one or other location, there could be a slight overcapacity, but in general, it levels out quite well, and it allows really to drive the energy transition forward.
And the context here is that 2045, Germany net zero. So that's the policy. I believe it's constitutional. And therefore, the plans all have to end up at that point. They're not allowed to be anywhere else. But you're not building for 2045. And that plan for 2045 would cost, I believe, between transmission and distribution, it's 650 billion euros is the figure that that ChatGPT told me, 650 billion. Half of it transmission, not all yours, but presumably a big chunk because you're the biggest of the transmission operators. So you've got that 2045 number. How much is released for you to invest, because you say it's reviewed every 2 years, presumably you are not pulling the trigger on everything that you need for 2045, which would be a real leap of faith.
So in the past, the grid development plan was always looking 10 years ahead and then every 2 years renewed. So every 2 years, looking 2 years further. The problem a little bit is also then in the acceptance with the people that you have a kind of salami tactic. You bring in a line and say the people it's needed here, and then they understand and say, okay. I accept it. And 2 years later, you come and say, and now I need another one. So we convinced also the regulator and the government a couple of years ago that we should start with the end in mind. So what is needed for 2045? And nowadays, the grid development plan is looking to this target, to 2045, and then has the scenario in between. The current one is 2037. So that you see what is needed more urgently and what is then the entire grid on the long term. And that helps on the acceptance side because everything is known. And then still we can adapt. What we are doing is we are planning very concrete the next 5 to 10 years, because that is where you also have to early start the investment. And as I said, for 25 to 29, we are investing 65 billion, so an average 13 billion a year.
Cleaning Up is supported by its leadership circle. The members are Actis, Alcazar Energy, Arup, Signum Capital, Davidson Kempner, Ecopragma Capital, EDP of Portugal, Eurelectric, the Gilardini Foundation, KKR, National Grid, Octopus Energy, Quadrature Climate Foundation, SDCL, and Wärtsilä. For more information on the Leadership Circle, please visit cleaningup.live. If you've enjoyed this episode, please hit like, leave a comment, and also recommend it to friends, family, colleagues, and absolutely everyone. To browse the archive of over 200 past episodes, and also to subscribe to our free newsletter, visit cleaningup.live. That's cleaningup.live. You make it sound very sort of rational, very calm, everything's under control, but there is also a huge grid connection pipeline. Bottleneck, you could call it. And across the country, it is, across Europe, I believe it's something like 2 terawatts of backed up projects that are waiting for the grids, the various grids, not just your own. I've seen a figure for your area of something like 50 gigawatts of, I believe it's batteries alone that is backed up. So why is there why are there so many people complaining to me and to others that they have to wait till 2037 to get a grid connection?
Yeah, indeed. We have a huge queue all over Europe. If I look at Germany, we have been overwhelmed by battery requests in the last 2 years. 3 years ago, on the transmission level, we have seen no batteries. They were all in the distribution. Now we have 250 gigawatts of requests only in the transmission grid. This is 3 times our peak load. And we all know that they will not all invest because they will not have a business case. Once the first 20% has invested, then the business case for the rest will be gone. But we have a system, a regulatory system, where this is called a first-come, first-served principle. So the one that is first in the queue gets a connection. And therefore, everybody is now running to be the first one in the queue.
You've created the perfect conditions for a race to get in the queue,
exactly,
which completely masks any real signal of what demand is.
Exactly. And that's a little bit the problem. That is also why we are now recommending to change the system to a more maturity and system supporting criteria system, where it's dependent on how realistic is your planning. Do you have the land plot already? Do you have taken your investment decision? Have you secured the supply chain that you need? Those criteria, and are you supporting with your business model the system, or are you just taking advantage of the system? So we have, as Germany, with one price zone, we have one price signal, and we have batteries that are north of a bottleneck and others that are south. But they are reacting in the same way on the price signal. That means on the one side of the bottleneck, they are supporting us. On the other one, they do the opposite. And that is why I think it's urgently needed that we change the system and that those criteria, who is really supporting and also creating value for the customers, get prioritization in the connection.
And we have that in the UK as well. So we have a lot of renewables in the north and offshore, which a lot of it comes into Scotland and the north, and then a lot of demand in the south. And something like a quarter of the time, because we only have one price and a constrained grid, something like a quarter of the time, our interconnections to other countries are flowing in the unhelpful way, because the price signal has said, oh, prices are going to be high, so buy in from France or Ireland or Norway or Denmark, when we should actually be doing the opposite. When in fact in the south, we've, you know, it flips. It's more likely that the price is low and then France buys electricity, which we can't then supply from renewables. The solution to that feels to me like splitting the price zones. Is that under discussion? I mean, I know it's under discussion, but how can I put it? Is that a real debate? Is it really likely to happen in Germany? And if not, how do you solve that problem that you talk about of the batteries kind of dispatching when they should be being loaded and loading when they should be being dispatched? How do you do that if it's not zonal pricing?
So indeed, in the first moment, zonal pricing seems to be the obvious solution, but it's much more complex. First of all, if you want to change the current system to a zonal pricing system, it will take you 4 to 5 years to integrate it into the system. So it's nothing you can do overnight. And at the same time, the root cause are the bottlenecks in the grid. So we are solving those bottlenecks with all the investments that we are doing. So in 5 years' time from now, we have probably the bottlenecks at complete different areas like today. So then the question is, what is the right design of the price zones to really get to what you want? And at the same time, you create a lot of uncertainty also for industry because you are in a transition phase. So that makes it very, very difficult. What makes it even more difficult in Germany is that we are a federal state with 16 states in the federal government, and they have different interests. Because if you split the price zone, then of course the prices in the south will go up, and in the north they will be a little lower. So the states in the south, they are immediately in the opposition, and it's really hard to get to the core of the content because it's such an emotional topic. And what I see currently also in the German environment politics associations, I don't think that is something that we can easily come to. So therefore, we are focusing on really investing into our grid and find other ways of dispatching, for example, new customers like batteries in a way with other incentives that helps to react to what is happening.
I did say you had two problems, which is the wind, the offshore wind, and then I said Bavaria, but the south and the challenge there. So Sweden, I understand, introduced zonal pricing in 15 months, but I don't really want to, you know, debate how long it takes to change all of the pricing systems. Germany is more complicated than Sweden. We had the same conversations in the UK, and it became a sort of totemic number that it would take 5 to 7 years. I personally am not sure about that. But the choice that is being made and that you're describing is almost what you're calling copperplate country. Copperplate in the sense that you can put electricity into it anywhere and take it out anywhere, and the grid can cope. Can the grid really do that? Can your transmission investment achieve that, given how much you're going to invest in offshore wind, particularly the big area of growth of renewables, which is the big, you know, mostly what you're going to invest in is renewables, and most of it's going to be offshore wind. So is it possible to then copperplate between that and those people in the south who want the cheap electricity?
I think there's no easy answer to that. First of all, I think completely copperplating cannot be the solution. So you also have to talk about curtailment, and that is also what we currently do with the regulator. In the grid plant, there's always a certain level of curtailment that you allow, because on the last mile, it's not really efficient. Nevertheless, Germany is in a complete different position than most of the other European countries. On the one hand, the largest electricity market. On the other hand, we are at the core of the European continent. So we are also facilitating the energy flows from the Nordics, where you have a lot of renewables, very cheap, to the south of Europe. And we are also allowing the flows from the east to the west and the other way around, because also France and Poland have very different generation profiles. So we are really in the middle of it, and only part of it is for what we need in Germany. The rest is also to facilitate the European market. And of course, this is a high investment, but still, I think it's the best thing that we can do. And it's the backbone of the German or of the European economy. So if we want to be successful in Europe, this is an asset that you find nowhere else in the world. A grid that is so highly meshed, about such a distance from Portugal to the Ukraine, from the Nordics to the south of Europe. And at the same time, industry is never more than a couple of tens kilometers away from the grid infrastructure. So, and we have a high availability of our grid. So in the transmission grid in Germany, we have provided 100% availability in the last years. So there has been not a single outage. This is a value for industry and for our economics that is highly underestimated. And I think that should be used in Europe to really develop from there the economy.
And certainly as the debate turns to resilience, and obviously the power cut in Spain and Portugal in April this year focused a lot of minds, as did, of course, Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine and this whole trend in geopolitics towards Europe being much more self-reliant. And when I say Europe, I mean the UK clearly, you know, as well as not just the EU, but all of Europe. So resilience is in the spotlight. And I think you make a very good point that the country with the most resilient grid does have an advantage, and we don't market that. A question about Germany sits in the middle of Europe, and you have east-west flows and you have north-south flows. How does that get paid for? I mean, can't you get them to pay for your copper plate since they're using it?
Now, we have a market regulation in Europe which obliges us to provide a certain capacity of our interconnection capacity to the markets. That is what we are doing. Paid, we get by the German regulatory system. So this is also decoupled from us.
And we've just talked about a lot of the kind of, I would say, the mainland system, but you're also very active connecting up those offshore wind farms, doing it to a certain extent on a sort of unilateral German basis, but also working with other of the North Sea countries, UK as well. Talk to me about the split. How much of what you're investing in, you've got that 65 billion, how much of that is your own, in a sense, mainland copper plate, and how much of it is actually going to be about importing the offshore wind into Germany? And I suppose the third category is interconnections to neighboring countries. So you've got those three chunks. How does it split up?
And let me maybe start first of all, why are we doing that? I think you talked about resilience. So from a resilience perspective, we have to be independent. And the most independent source are the renewables, especially offshore wind, because it's highly available. We have more than 300 gigawatt of potential in the North Sea alone. So this is a huge energy source for Europe, and we have to connect offshore wind in a most efficient way. We have been the first TSO investing highly into offshore, especially into HVDC technology. So this is direct current that you need if you go for long distances offshore. You cannot use the alternating current. We have been for 15 years the only operator globally operating those systems offshore. Nowadays, we have 10 gigawatts connected to the German mainland. But this is just the starting point. There's so much more. As I said, there's 300 gigawatts of potential. And if you want to do it in an efficient way, you have to do it together in Europe. So not only EU, also UK included. And that is why we started already a cooperation between the TSOs around the North Sea to provide a design for a grid to make it in the most efficient way for Europe. And we are working on that together with the North Sea Energy Corporation of the member states to push this thinking forward.
So instead of having each wind farm connected by a single line to the coast or to the country in question, this would be more of a web type approach, and saying the wind farms connected to each other and the countries then connected through that to each other as well. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely. As I said, we are using direct current technology. Those are point-to-point connection, or often say radials. So it's the connection from the wind farm to the grid onshore. That means we are transporting more or less the wind profile. So the turbine is just generating what the wind is providing. That is in the North Sea, usually 4,000 hours a year. So half of the time is this connection really used. We see now, because of the ambitious targets of the German government of 70 gigawatts in a rather small sea area, that we're seeing wake effects. So the turbines are covering themselves from the wind. And therefore, the full load hours go down from 4,500 to 2,500, 2,200. That means that we are using our grid infrastructure only 25% of the time. And that's, of course, not very efficient with those highly expensive assets. If you now combine such an asset with an interconnector, we do it, for example, between Netherlands and the UK with Lion Link, then you invest just in 20 kilometers more cable and you get a full-fledged interconnector on top of your offshore connection, and then you can use it for 8,000 hours. And that's the thinking behind, and that is why we think this is the right way. And coming back to your initial question, half of our investments are offshore and half is onshore.
And the offshore is then interconnection as well as wind farms.
Yeah, it's mainly right. Wind farm connections, but it's also interconnections.
So now, but that raises a very interesting question, which is that feels like a very pan-European conversation. I mean, of course, you've got Norway and you've got UK and not in the EU. But when you talk about the Netherlands or you talk about Belgium, you talk about Denmark and you talk about these flows east-west going across Germany, north-south going across Germany, why wouldn't the right regulator for all of this be Brussels?
I think we need common rules. That's really important. That is also where we see that we are currently getting a little bit stuck because everybody is looking for their own cost and benefit. So we have to overcome this, and therefore we need common rules. If we do it directly on the European level, we think it will take a lot of time because the countries around the North Sea, they have a common interest to find an efficient way to connect. But if you look at Italy or Greece, they have a complete different view on that. They have also different challenges to solve. And therefore, to come a common model where all 27 say that's the way to go, including Norway and UK, I think that will take years. And therefore, we rather think in regions, so the North Sea, for example, the Baltic Sea, the Mediterranean, and find solutions in a more regional approach with the countries involved around a sea basin.
So if I push back just slightly, I had an episode with Nikos Tsafos, who's the assistant, the deputy minister of energy in Greece. Actually, when we recorded it, he wasn't. But then by the time we published it, he was. And what he was describing was, you know, Greece, fabulous solar resource and actually a fabulous wind resource as well. The Aeolian Islands, the Aeolian is the winds, and all of Greece has got fabulous wind. But there are times when you don't have either. So if you have an energy system which is dependent on variable renewables, you can have the best resources in the world 90% of the time. But he was talking about, and when we don't, we'll bring in electricity from the North Sea. Now, how does that get built in? Because if you do everything regionally, you'll end up with self-correlating resources. So you'll have these islands that are, in the end, for the last 10% or the last 20%, dependent on each other. So again, the question, I suppose, is whether what is happening, those rules at the Brussels level, are they not perhaps a bit more important than you're saying? Because without that last 20%, you don't have a clean system. The system falls over unless you solve that.
First of all, I would say we have already a European system in place and we have a lot of interconnections also all over Europe. The question is now how you get accelerated some investments in those areas where it's most beneficial. And if you try that to solve with common rules, I think it will just take more time. Therefore, it's not either or, but it's just on top of the European system that we are having, provide some acceleration measures in certain regions. And of course, Greece has a huge potential. We are also looking into an interconnector between Germany and Greece. But it's also quite a long distance. You have to cross the Alps and you are connecting Greece with a mainly solar-dominated profile with the south of Germany, Bavaria, which is also highly solar-dominated. So you really have to look then into the cases where makes it more sense. And if I look to the North Sea, for example, there is much more potential to easily gain before you look then into interconnections really on long, long distances.
I want to talk about the supply chain as well, because this came up in the conversation with John Pettigrew. It's the conversation. We've gotten this far into the discussion without mentioning AI and data centers. They're buying all the transformers, they're buying the cable, they're buying the electricity. But how do you move fast, given that everybody is trying to do the same thing and the supply chain is limited? And does that not just result in enormous inflation, frustration, and grid connection queues?
Yeah, indeed. We have seen huge interruptions in the supply chain, starting with the war in the Ukraine and the energy crisis. And we still see that the supply chains are not like they have been 10 years ago. As I said, we invest very much into direct current technology, HVDC. About half of our investments. And this is a very constrained market. There are only a few players globally in this market. So we have seen very early that there will be huge constraints. And I have been traveling around myself to many of our key suppliers to asking them what is needed that they start to invest in additional production capacity.
And I know what they said. Let me guess. Give me an order. Give me a long-term order and I will build capacity.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit more complex, because one order will not change the system. What they said, they need predictability.
Yes.
And they said also they cannot invest on political ambitions. They have seen so many political ambitions over the years, and they have then always seen that, yeah, the development was different. So they were very, very hesitant. And then we said, okay, what can we do to give more predictability? And we went to many with our suppliers into long-term partnerships, indeed, with a long-term view on what they can expect from us. So 10, 15 years of portfolio already committed from our side. But we also obliged them to invest into production capacity. And for example, we have tendered 3 years ago our 2 gigawatt program offshore. So that means a fleet of 2,000 megawatt offshore connections, all in HVDC technology with different suppliers. We have created a 15 years framework. And with the first call off, so with the first chunk of projects we used from this framework, we committed 50 billion euros to the market. And that was a game changer.
And just for the audience to get a picture of what is it that you've just bought, these 2 gigawatt, this is a floating, this looks like an oil rig, but it's actually a substation. Is that right?
It looks like an oil rig. It's not floating. It's in the North Sea. We have rather shallow waters, so it's bottom fixed. And it's a what we call converter platform. So it's also not really a substation, because that is usually what you use on the AC side. It's an asset that allows us to transmit the AC current that is produced by the wind farms over long distances with DC current, and then transform it back or convert it back onshore. So it's 2 converters, one offshore, one onshore, a platform, and a cable or a cable system in between.
Thank you. So I was sort of, it's not floating and it's not a substation, but it's a big chunk of electrical kit on something that is, I mean, it's floating, not floating. It is, a lot of it would be originally oil field services technology to put that sort of asset out in the sea. But then your system that you've placed the orders for is that piece, the cable, and then the onshore piece of that, which then converts it back and puts it into the grid.
Right. And to give you a little bit a glimpse of the scale, it's like a soccer field, 25 meters above the water and then 40 meters high.
And how much is each one of these? You've placed a 50 billion euro forward order, presumably lots of negotiations about break clauses. But you've placed that. How many units was that?
14.
14?
Yeah. 8 okay. for the Netherlands and 6 for Germany.
So we're talking about three and a bit billion euros each system. And did you do that on your own, or were you working with the other grid operators, the other TSOs, or have they each done the same sort of thing or together
in
or separately?
In this particular case, we have been the first mover in Europe. We see now that this model is used also by other TSOs. What we did is we shared our technical specifications, so all our know-how, with all European TSOs that were interested in. If you can say, why are you doing that when you are 15 years ahead? That's not logical. But in the end, is what we are doing is financed more or less by public money, by the money of the grid customer. So we think we have here a responsibility. And on the other hand, it helps our supply chain to more standardize. Because if they are all using the same technical specification, it's easier for the supply chain and they can get more output. So that is where we also benefit again.
Okay, so we need to get on to closing. We come back to that financial transaction, right? How do you finance all of this? Because you got your 9.5 billion euros of new equity. So you've whatever's in the business, but you've got 9.5 billion. You want to spend 65 billion. You've actually already spent 50 billion, right? Is what you're saying. You've already got commitments for just for this one piece of it. And how do you go about, how are you going about raising the rest of it? Because that's kind of a core challenge. And I suspect it's a lot of your day is talking to the capital markets. So yeah. How are you doing that?
So in the past, we have been done the financing all via the TenneT holding. Now we do it on the German level. So the first step was to get the equity in, and we have the commitment of 9.5 billion, as you mentioned. And now we are preparing ourselves for the debt market. The first step was just recently the syndication of a revolving credit facility of 12 billion euros.
So that's almost like we would call that an overdraft in the kind of the retail market. That would just be, you can use it for whatever. It's not connected to a project.
It's not connected to a project. It's more like an insurance. So it's just backing that you are ensuring that you have the liquidity that you need. So it's not a financing instrument in itself, but it gives you the access then to go into the debt market. And then we will start next year going to the debt market with amounts roughly about 10 billion a year, raising then the capital for the investment that we have, as I said, about 13 billion investments each year.
So 10 billion a year over 5 years becomes 50 billion. You add it to the 9.5. You've got your overdraft facility. Those 10 billionses, each time you do it, will they be linked to specific parts of the grid, specific projects? So will you say, here's a new interconnector, you know the payback, will it come into the company? So it'll just be
right
on the balance sheet?
It will come into the company and we finance everything on the company level.
So everything will come in on the company level. And your credit rating, have you already got your own independent credit rating, or is also you're negotiating?
We are currently in the process of it, but we are striving for a BBB+ credit rating. And that is also where we are completely convinced that we will be able to maintain that on the long term.
So interestingly, BBB+, and I don't know what other utilities or other TSOs are, but that is just below investment grade, right?
It is investment grade.
It is classed as investment grade. Okay, and it's not a sovereign rating. So the question is, you know, why would it not be higher? Given that fundamentally, doesn't the German state stand behind you now?
The German state, not the Dutch state, is still standing behind us as the majority shareholder, still holding 54%, and 46% is with the new investors. It's a little bit because of the regulatory system that we are having, because the regulator is assuming a fixed 40-60 share of equity and debt. And if we gear it, then we have a little bit chances here to outperform the regulatory system. And that is how we get our earnings.
So the guarantee by the Dutch for what's essentially a German core part of the German infrastructure that the German state can't see fail, that must make for some interesting conversations at cocktail parties, possibly in Brussels. But I'm familiar with this process of running up each year, going into the debt markets. I was on the board of Transport for London. I was on the finance committee. And indeed, we did exactly the same. The reason why Transport for London was created, separated out from being a nationalized, effectively, operation, was to be able to go into the debt markets. And over a period of time, you run up the debt. And then, of course, you get criticized because you've got so much debt. So not everybody, perhaps this episode of Cleaning Up can be referred to explain why you're managing the finances the way you are, because some activists and some of the audience, maybe some of the existing audience, will say that you should not be taking risk by raising debt and financializing what you're doing. It's a core asset of Germany. Germany should own it.
Yeah. On the other hand, we are in a very long-term business and we are building assets. So we have an asset base and a value against it. And also on the equity side, we will be self-funding after this period of 65 billion investments, because our asset base will triple the next 5 years, from currently a little bit around 30 billion, then to more than 85 billion in 29. And with that, we are able to also maintain our long-term financing in a very solid way.
So that's going to be an interesting conversation. And I will already invite you back onto Cleaning Up in 2029, because at that point, you will be looking at the rest of your capital spend. So I said that ChatGPT had told me it was 650 billion across transmission and distribution for transmission operators, not just you, but that's through till 2045. There'll be episode two or the second act of all of this, which starts presumably 2030 through to 2045, where you will still need to be building that copper plate Germany, right?
Yeah, indeed. So as I said, we are expecting now for the next 5 years to invest 13 billion a year. In the years after 29, we expect still investments of around 10 billion a year.
Well, I'm going to wish you the very, very best of luck. And thank you for spending time with us here today on Cleaning Up.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
So that was Tim Meyer-Jürgens, the CEO of TenneT Germany, who also sponsored the episode. As always, we'll put links in the show notes to resources that we mentioned during our conversation. So that's episode 227, my conversation with John Pettigrew, the outgoing CEO of National Grid, and episode 201 with Nikos Tsafos, the Deputy Minister of Energy in Greece. We'll also put a link to TenneT Germany's website and to the press announcement of their recent major fundraising. And so with that, it remains for me to thank Oscar Boyd, our producer, Jamie Oliver, our video editor, the team behind Cleaning Up, the Leadership Circle, who make all of this possible, and you, the audience, for spending some time with us here today. And please join us this time next week for another episode of Cleaning Up. Cleaning Up is supported by its Leadership Circle. The members are Actis, Alcazar Energy, Arup, Signum Capital, Davidson Kempner, Ecopragma Capital, EDP of Portugal, Eurelectric, the Gilardini Foundation, KKR, National Grid, Octopus Energy, Quadrature Climate Foundation, SDCL, and Wärtsilä. For more information on the Leadership Circle, please visit cleaningup.live. If you've enjoyed this episode, please hit like, leave a comment, and also recommend it to friends, family, colleagues, and absolutely everyone. To browse the archive of over 200 past episodes, and also to subscribe to our free newsletter, visit cleaningup.live. That's cleaningup.live.